Hey guys, Ed here. Sorry, I am a little late. I was actually in the wrong meeting and wondering why there was nobody there. So anyway, it's good to be here. Hey, just while I get things set up, let me know in the chat area, just for fun, the great book that you've read lately. It could be fiction, nonfiction, doesn't really matter. Just type it in the chat area. That also tells me that you're here and paying attention. And it's good to see many familiar faces here. I'm going to get things set up and we'll go ahead and get started here in a sec. Let's see. We got some good ones here. Alma says, gentlemen in Moscow must read. I had heard that name. I think it's like the second time I've heard about that this month. I think I may have to add that to my reading list. Lee says, The Happiness Advantage, Sean Aker. Excellent book. So, so good. Love that book. Good one, Lee. I am personally at night reading. I love to read just a little bit of fiction, something that keeps me engaged, and it's a true page-turner. I love to read that kind of stuff at night. In bed, and I sleep like a champ. And I'm reading a book by Lee Child. It's one of his Jack Reacher books. For those of you who are familiar with him, those who are not, it's kind of like think of it as Mission Impossible or James Bond, like that kind of genre. And just really well done. It's, you know, nothing crazy about it, but in terms of, well, some of the storylines are pretty engaging, but it's, it keeps you on your toes and it's hard to put down. Good stuff if you're looking for that kind of writing. Constellations of Philosophy, fun nonfiction, says Hannah. Good to see that. I hadn't heard of that one. Brothers and Friends, Diaries of Warren Hamilton Lewis, brother of C.S. Lewis. Oh, interesting. From Tim. Francis saying, audio is coming in broken. Okay, so let me know if my audio is broken or maybe it's coming through just on Francis' side. Sometimes it does that. And it's not necessarily on my end, but okay, so Robin's saying hearing loud and clear. Sounds good to me. Okay, cool. Francis, hard to say sometimes, and I've been on that side too, where I'm hearing people come in broken. Sometimes it could be on your end, maybe the bandwidth is just kind of fluctuating. Sometimes strong, sometimes not. Okay. Let's see, what else? John Grisham, Camino Island. Good one. Deep Work and So Good They Can't Ignore You by Cal Newport. Us classics, Liz, from Liz. Manhattan Beach by Jennifer Egan. Good stuff. Hey, great recommendations. The Watchmen, Robert Cray. Good stuff. I just finished reading. I won't even say what it was because somebody, and I'm not sure if they're going to be here, but somebody recommended it to me. If you ever start reading one of those books and you're just waiting for it to get good, but then about a third of the way or halfway through, you realize, you know, this is probably not going to get any better. But, you know, this feeling of your sunk cost, you've already invested so much in it that you know, you feel bad putting it down and you read it all the way to the end and then realize, yeah, this is crap. just finished reading one of those recently and it's painful. Life's too short for books you don't like. Yeah, and I usually, Tim, put them down. I just don't, you're right, because I usually don't have time. But it had so much promise. Like, I really thought they were building up to something better. You know what I should have done is after the fact, I said, you know, I wonder if it's me, because this book, people were ranting and raving about it. I went to the reviews on Amazon, and that's when I saw people, there were a lot of mixed reviews, a lot of people who felt like I did. I should have done that a little bit sooner, because then I would have realized, okay, this is not going to go anywhere. The Coming Fury, The Watchmen, Expanse series by James Corey. The Hunger Games, just for fun. Yeah, Read, I think, two of them. They were definitely page turners for sure. Yeah, good stuff, guys. All right. Well, let's get started. I like to do these every once in a while, and these are just an opportunity for us to just have a chat and really for me to serve you and maybe answer questions you might have, maybe give you feedback on a situation you might be facing. So I am here at your disposal and happy to talk about whatever might be going on in your business and maybe the challenge you might be facing. I do have a couple of some ideas that I'd like to share with you first. And really what I've done here, by the way, before I get to that, just FYI, I got everybody on mute automatically. So you're joining the call, you're automatically muted, so there's no need to mute yourself. But do not unmute yourself, please. So when we come to the Q&A part of the call, then I'll go ahead and bring you in. And if we need to have a conversation, of course, I'll unmute you. The other thing that I wanted to let you know is don't click on the start video button, because what that does, and I think it's really mislabeled on Zoom's part, but start video actually turns on your camera. And in fact, let me do that for me here. All right, so here I am. But if you do that, it turns on your camera. A lot of people click it thinking it's there's like a video component to this call, and there's not. So what you're seeing right now, I got some slides for you, but that's it. So you may not be camera ready, and you may not want the camera to be on. So that's it. So let me just walk through some ideas and where these are coming from. Basically, I sat down the other day and I took some notes on some of the common themes that I'm seeing in coaching calls that I'm having with my coaching clients. Things that have been coming up over and over again. And I kind of narrowed down to five things that I keep seeing that I thought I'd bring up here. And I figured, if one or two of these are helpful, then maybe if nothing else, this time together will be worth your while. So let me dive right into the first one. This idea of blog commoditization. This is something I've been seeing for the past couple of years. I think over the trend that I've been seeing is over the past 5 years, you're seeing more and more clients, businesses, organizations, entrepreneurs, you name it, wanting to outsource the blog writing to a writer. I think many times just because blogging has hit mainstream and it's the kind of thing that's hard to keep up with. So from a content marketing standpoint, many companies, if they're going to do anything, they're going to do a blog, right? That's the one thing they're going to start with, blog or newsletter or both. It's hard to stay on top of it. So the good news is that it's hit mainstream. The bad news is that because there are so many people looking and so many writers willing to do it, it's that type of work has been commoditized. When I say commoditized, I mean there's a lot of price pressure, mainly because there's so many people who are willing to do it, who are willing to do the work. And it's also the kind of thing that many clients already have a fee in their mind for. So they're coming into it already with a number in mind, which puts you as a disadvantage. Now, think about other types of projects. There are many different types of marketing communication projects, many times, depending on what you do, whether you're doing design, content creation, translation. But think about the other types of projects where these are not published prices, right? It could really be a wide range, and those gives you they give you an advantage because you could price the work based on a number of factors. But when it comes to blogging, in most cases there's a narrower range, and it's usually toward the bottom. So it really puts you at again great disadvantage. And the key idea that I want to share here is that if it's not that you shouldn't do blogging. But you need to think about it a little more strategically. If you are starting your business or in the early stages, I think blogging is absolutely fine. It's a great way to get in with some clients, to get your foot in the door, start building some momentum. However, if you're already an established freelancer, this is not the best place to start with a client. And many of them, I see way too many established freelancers start here thinking this is a great way to get in the door. And then once you get your foot in the door, you're able to work into your way into other higher paying projects. And I'm not seeing that as being the case in most situations. There are exceptions, absolutely. So just be careful. If you're seeing blog opportunities come through, I would qualify them pretty intensely before you spend a lot of time with prospects who are just not going to be a good fit, mainly because they're looking, the pay is way too low, especially if you're more established and are looking for higher paying clients. If you're starting out, I think that's fine. Either way, you want to make sure that you qualify the opportunity well. The other thing I would say is the exceptions that I'm seeing in terms of commoditization, where it's not happening as much, as with highly specialized topics. So very technical topics or topics in very specialized or niched industries or subjects. So those are definitely exceptions, but that's not the bulk of what's out there. The bulk of what's out there are things that many other people could write. So that's the first thing, is just this idea that I'm just seeing so much more of this, and I have been seeing over the past couple of years. The other thing that I'm noticing is I'm getting a lot of questions, and I have for a while, but it's been, I've seen an uptick over the past few months. This question of how much prospecting should I do? You know, it's like people want a formula. And I do have a basic formula that will give you some guidance, a rule of thumb. And the first thing you need to ask yourself is, well, what's my pipeline look like in terms of prospects and in terms of existing work? If you're book solid, my recommendation is 10% of your work week, whatever time you're dedicating to your work every week, you should consider spending on some sort of tangible marketing activity. Now, it could be a combination of prospecting, maybe some content marketing, inbound marketing work, whatever, but 10% of your work week should be dedicated, as a rule of thumb, to prospecting if you are book solid. So if you dedicate 40 hours a week to your business, then about 4 hours should be dedicated to marketing. In some cases, it could be all prospecting, or it could be a mix, depending on your prospecting strategy, your prospecting plan. Now, if you're not book solid, then the question really, it's more of a, it's a different kind of formula. What I would do is I would figure out how many hours a week you're dedicating to your business. And let's just take that 40, just to stick with that. And then also figure out how many hours a week, roughly, you have of client work right now. Client work in must do administrative work. So in other words, invoicing, maybe a little bit of bookkeeping, follow up, get set up, get organized, project planning, those kinds of things. It's not necessarily billable work. So billable work, client work, plus those necessary administrative duties. And just for the sake of simplicity, let's say you work a 40-hour week and you have about 20 hours of work right now, including those basic administrative functions. Not busy work, but the basic stuff that needs to be done. The answer is, in terms of what you should be doing for prospecting, is the rest of the time, 20 hours, what's left over, should be dedicated to prospecting. To me, that is a very sensible and easy answer to something that puzzles so many freelance creatives. Like, how much should I do? Well, figure out how much work you got. Subtract that from the total time that you're allotting to your business every week. There's your answer. That's how much time you should spend on strategic and focused prospecting, not busy work, but actually strategic prospecting. I want to share a thought experiment that may or may not be helpful for you. It has been for a lot of coaching clients that I've shared this with, and some others have been a little bit turned off, but I think it definitely, if anything, it's going to leave an impression. If you have children, and let's just say that there was no food in the house and your children were starving. I mean, they really were. And again, I apologize for, you know, for being so dramatic and so graphic. But if you were in that situation, how much prospecting would you do if you needed to bring cash in the door, if you needed to bring income and work in the door? And I bet that if you're a parent, you know, if you have pets, that's fine. Use your pets as an example. You would do whatever it took. You wouldn't just work the extra 20 hours that you don't have work for. You'd probably go even way beyond that without question. So the interesting thing about that thought experiment is it takes things to an extreme and gives you clarity in the process. So that's something that, you know, you could ask yourself if you're having doubt or if you're not sure how much you do. And maybe the issue is you have a safety net. Maybe the issue is, you know, you're not really that hungry right now. I'm not judging. I'm just saying that that's going to give you the clarity you need to figure out, okay, well, maybe I'm not doing as much as I should because I don't really need to, or I'm not motivated. But what if I were in this extreme situation, would I get motivated at that point? Okay. So anyway, something to just some food for thought there. The next issue that I wanted to bring up is this idea of cash flow management. So usually when this comes up is because somebody is telling me, look, I had this client, they were very steady. It was about $3,000 worth of work every month. And I've been doing work for them at kind of at that level for the past 18 months. And suddenly they went out of business. I mean, without warning. Or maybe my main contact there left abruptly, and now I can't get their boss to return my calls. I don't know, you know, I don't know what's going on. And I got $3,000 a month at stake here, and right now I'm not really sure where that's going. Or you know, I've been used to very steady work for the past couple of years, and I don't know what happened this summer, but I'm down 50%. Over the past 3 months. You know, I'm really, really scared. And I find that so much of this can be avoided, and I've learned this the hard way, by having a system for managing your cash flow. What I've noticed, and again, I'm guilty of this, okay? I've been guilty of this, I've changed, is that as freelancers, we treat cash receipts like a paycheck. And what I mean by that is whatever comes in, we look at it and go, oh, cool, income. When, and there's a reason for that. I mean, most of us have worked in a traditional job for many years and, you know, your paycheck was your paycheck. But now we're in a situation where cash receipts are not necessarily your paycheck. That's just cash receipts. And we don't have a system to better allocate incoming receipts appropriately and to pay ourselves a real salary, pay something that we can depend on like we did when we had a day job. So you can absolutely do this. You just need to have a basic process where, you know, think of the envelope system where any cash receipts that come in are automatically allocated in a certain fashion. Certain percent, and I recommend percentages, certain percentage for this, certain percentage of that, certain percentage of this, and you're paying yourself a fixed salary. Now, you don't have to take a traditional salary necessarily. You don't have to do payroll. But what I mean is a certain amount every 2 weeks or once a month that's fixed. And you don't bring it up until your cash receipts have hit a certain average number or until certain accounts in your, you know, because you can set up different bank accounts for each of these purposes, have hit certain levels. Now, I'm not going to get into too much into this. There's a great book out there. If you haven't read it, I strongly, strongly recommend it. If you do one thing today, buy this book. It's called Profit First by Mike Michalowicz. You can find it on Amazon. Just type in Profit First. His name is hard to spell. And it will show you how to, it's basically a combination of the envelope system in this concept of pay yourself first that many of us have grown up with. But when it comes to our business, we're not sure how to apply that. So I can't recommend that book enough. And I'm telling you, most of the problems that I'm seeing out there in terms of those scenarios that I just described could be mostly eliminated if you implement a process where you don't have to spend time making decisions. The process makes the decisions for you. You're allocating cash receipts in a certain way, different accounts, and then you know what you got coming in, and suddenly you lose a client, it's not the end of the world, okay? Because you're actually paying yourself something every month that's less than what's coming in. which sounds great in theory, but it actually works in practice if you implement a system like that. So something that I think the combination of cash flow management and this prospecting idea, I mean, if you do steady prospecting and you do it strategically, so not just, you know, haphazard, strategic prospecting and good cash flow management, it will solve 95% of the problems in your business that could come up. Okay. The fourth idea that I want to talk about is this idea of differentiating. You've heard me talk about, if you followed my stuff for a while, about positioning. I feel very strongly that positioning is really the foundation from which everything related to your marketing, your services is built on. You got to have strong positioning. One of the objections that I get from people who don't want to specialize or pick a niche, a word that I'm not really a fan of, or pick an industry, is that they want to remain generalists. And the argument usually goes, you know, I'm a generalist. I love the variety. And listen, there's nothing wrong with that. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't differentiate yourself. You can be a generalist and still differentiate yourself. Okay. So positioning has four pillars: what you do, for whom, what makes you different, and why that difference matters. And you can still define all four of those things, even if you're a generalist. Okay. So, sorry, I just got something in my eye, but you don't have to pick an industry. Okay. What I mean by differentiating is pick something that makes you different from most. It doesn't have to be different from everybody. Let's just say you have a talent for translating the complex into terms and language that just the everyday people, lay people, can understand. Okay. That's a way to differentiate. Or I help marketers tell stories that capture hearts and inspire action. It's another great way to differentiate. Notice I didn't mention an industry. I just talk about what I do that's different. What makes me different? Okay. I work with businesses that are selling products and services to millennials. Okay. So a lot of different ways to slice and dice this, but just because you're a generalist doesn't preclude you from differentiating. Doesn't mean you should stop or ignore this idea of differentiation. Okay, you still have to be very, very clear about what makes you different and why those differences would matter to your ideal clients. And it could still be a wide range of industries and topics, but you have to talk about what makes you different. All right, finally, I wanted to mention one more thing that I'm seeing a lot of, which is this idea that you should focus on your foundation first. I'm seeing a lot of people way too focused on things that don't matter right now, when other things are broken and they're working on the wrong things. For instance, trying to launch a blog when you're starving for business and you should use that time to prospect instead for clients. Or trying to optimize your website and spending hours doing this when you just launched your freelance business. Okay. And the reason that that's kind of waste is that's not where your business is going to come from early on. Okay. Or creating a lead magnet or buzz piece when really everything that's coming in is $25 blog posts, you know, going back to this blog commoditization thing, rather than working on repositioning your business and being a little more strategic about what types of clients you go after, what, how you position yourself and so forth. So, I think the common cause of this is this shiny object syndrome. Many times it's not that we mean to do this, is we know what we need to work on, but then something comes along and we read an article or watch a video or hear this idea and it's like, oh, I got to be doing that. The problem is we jump from one thing to another without asking ourselves, well, wait a minute, what do I need to be focused on this week? And we end up working on things that aren't really going to move the needle in our business. So, you know, I like this metaphor of a foundation, because you wouldn't even start talking about paint color for a house until the house is got the foundation and it's framed, right? Maybe that's the point to start thinking about it, because you can't paint until it's framed and the walls are up and the siding is up. I see too many people worried about paint when they should be working on the foundation. Okay. So pull back every week and ask yourself, what do I need to be working on this week that's really going to move the needle? And many times you need to be honest with yourself. You know, why am I not working on the things that I need to be working on? What are you avoiding? Is it out of fear? Is it because maybe some of the things you need to be working on feel scary or uncomfortable? Or you're not sure what you should be doing? Sometimes it's confusion or indecision. That's fine. But get clear on that. And just because they're confusing or scary doesn't mean you shouldn't be doing them. So work on the foundational elements first, and then you can worry about window dressing. So that's it, guys. Just some, again, some things that that I've been seeing out there that I wanted to bring up here because they're important and they're going to make a difference in your business. And maybe some of these, or at least one of them, might resonate with you right now based on where you are. All right, so let's do this, guys. Again, I'm here for you, ready to answer questions, give you feedback on a situation you might be facing, maybe a dilemma, you're trying to make a decision, whatever it is. Type in, if you have a question, go to the chat area and type in capital Q. That lets me know that that's a question. And then just share with me your question, issue, dilemma, what you'd like for me to address. Again, just type it in the chat box. All I ask is that you keep it focused. You know, give me something that I can answer in 3 to 5 minutes. You know, don't ask something like, you know, how should I find clients? That's too broad. Okay, so tell me a little bit more about that. Okay, what are you doing right now? Maybe you have a specific question about how you're doing it. Whatever, right? Just keep it specific. Keep it as focused as possible. All right, so let's see here. Let me go through the chat area. Okay, Robin has a question here. I have 2 retainer clients that I've been working with for the past year plus at a steady rate. Both are pleased with my work, and they and I have been getting great feedback on my work. I'd like to raise my rates with them by 20 to 30%. Is it too soon to do that? And if not, how do I go about having that conversation with them? Okay. Yeah, great question. It's, you know, how do you raise your rates with existing clients? How much can you do it? When is the right time? All right. So some ideas, Robin, is the first is, I think it's fine. If it's been a year or longer, I think it's absolutely fine. And it sounds like you're at a point where you know you're definitely undercharging. A couple of ideas. One would be, this is a great time of year to talk about this with clients because we're coming to the fourth quarter. And one thing you could do is announce kind of an across the board price increase. And of course, you approach each client individually. You don't want to send out an email broadcast or anything like that. And just let them know that as of January 1st, your fees are going up. And let them know, depending on what you're doing for them, how much they're going up by. Now, let's talk about percentages. So that first idea of them going up is, the reason that tends to work well is businesses are used to that, right? It's like, hey, you know, it's another year, my fees have been going up. You could even include in your message, hey, you know, I've been keeping your fee steady. I'm getting, you know, X or so much more from new clients. And, you know, I'm not expecting you to go up to this level, but, you know, I can't continue to maintain these fees. And so starting January 1st, and you're giving them a grace period, okay, which is really nice and clients appreciate. So that's the first thing. The second thing, and I should have probably mentioned this first, okay, the biggest opportunity to raise your fees is not with existing clients, it's gonna be with new prospects, okay? That's the first thing to keep in mind because it's not the easiest thing in the world to get clients to accept higher fees, okay, period. Doesn't matter who they are. Typically, it's just not gonna be the easiest thing, number one. And number two, you're limited as to how much you can raise them by. I don't know of too many clients who would be willing to accept, even if it's a fair increase, I don't know too many who'd be able to accept a 50% increase as an example, okay? But a new prospect doesn't know what you normally charge for X. So the biggest opportunity is always going to be with new prospects. You want to get better paying clients, boost your income. One more reason to start prospecting. Do this with new prospects. However, if you're going to do it with existing clients, again, the across the board price increase, let them know, give them that 90-day window, let them know as of January 1st, this is my new pricing for this. Secondly, you're going to have to figure out how much you can reasonably boost your fees by. I'd say 10% is about right. 20% is on the higher side, but doable depending on where you are right now. Again, beyond that, it starts getting harder and harder. So the more you're wanting to raise them by, the more justification you're going to have to provide, and the more you're going to have to be willing to let some of them go. Okay. And I guess the final point there, Robin, is you also need to ask yourself before you do any of this is, are there any clients, and specifically these two, who you'd be willing to let go of? I mean, is it time? Because you might realize, and it doesn't sound like this is the case, but I just want to share this with everybody. If you're honest with yourself, you know, there's this one particular client that, you know what, we're just not a fit anymore. And rather than go through this whole annoying process, an exhausting process of announcing this fee increase to them, I'm just going to say that, you know, we need to go our separate ways. So sometimes that's the best thing. Again, I'm not saying that's the case for you, but sometimes it's easier to do that and better for both of you than it is to put them through this process. So I think you can absolutely do that. You should do that. But again, keep in mind the biggest opportunities for you are going to be with new clients, not with existing clients. You got to keep your expectations in check because the way the mind works, like it's very hard for people to accept large increases. We just anchor pricing on what we're used to, and anything above that, it's just going to be harder and harder to accept the higher it goes. Okay. Carol. Liz said, I know Liz, we've had this conversation before. She says, excellent advice. Cash flow management is a problem for all small businesses. In the book, Profit First Rocks. Yeah, couldn't agree more, Liz. I know we've had that conversation. I started implementing it earlier this year. It's just huge. Makes it so much easier. Carol has a question. I understand we should be prospecting for clients, but if I'm selling myself as a content marketing writer, shouldn't I have a blog and newsletter set up? If not, won't I look like a hypocrite to people I'm trying to sell those services to? Absolutely. So in your case, Carol, you should do both. So here's the thing. You don't want to put all your eggs in one basket, right? So prospecting is great because you can proactively look for business. You don't have to wait for it, okay? And you can pick and choose whom you target. It's fantastic. And if you're doing it efficiently and if you're doing it in a very targeted fashion, you can get really good at it and get results in a relatively short period of time, especially if you need to fill up that pipeline quickly. However, it's like a stock portfolio. You shouldn't, so prospecting, think of it as like small cap stocks, right? A lot of variability in pricing. You don't want to put your whole retirement savings in that. Inbound marketing, content marketing, which really feeds an inbound marketing strategy, is the other. It's like blue chip stocks, for instance, and bonds. So you should also be doing some content marketing and have an inbound marketing strategy in place. The advantage is that, yeah, not only are leads coming in, but usually when they come to you with an inquiry, they're partially sold on using you. I'm not saying they're ready to go, but they're interested. They've already checked you out. That's a great prospect to have. And in your case, again, because you're doing content marketing, it showcases your expertise. It shows how you apply these ideas in your own business. But again, now the disadvantage is that you have to wait for it to come to you, and it can be unpredictable. So you need the answer is you need both. The reason I really harp on prospecting is that I find that most freelance creative professionals just aren't doing enough of it. And they're not making up for it with a better inbound marketing strategy. Very rare for somebody to be doing a great job with inbound marketing. So, and if you're doing that, then that's fantastic. Then you could do 80% of that and 10 to 20% prospecting in terms of effort and energy. But if you're not, then one great way to get up to speed and start filling up that pipeline quickly is to go prospecting and do a serious focused prospecting effort for a certain period of time. Once you fill up that pipeline, then you should start planting the seeds for some inbound marketing to start working for you. So, this is a holistic approach that everyone should be taking. It's not one or the other. All right, it's different. Robin has a question. I have 2 trade shows coming up and would like to talk to my list about hiring me to interview their customers for case studies at the show. What is the best way to do this? By the way, the first show is having a half-day seminar before the show starts to discuss marketing, so it will be on their mind. Okay, great. Let me see, and this is to your list. All right, one great way, Robin, would be to and I think you're familiar with the 9-word email concept, right? It's so rather than do a blast of a, hey, I'm doing this work for this conference, and you could still do that, but I wouldn't start with that. You basically send a very short email to all the people on your list, including past clients, existing clients, prospects, and just with a short question. Hey, want me to, and I have to think about what the question would be. It's really a question that will open the door for a chat about this. Have you considered interviewing some of your successful customers at the ABC show next month? Something along those lines, right? Something that You're not saying, hey, have you hired me, or you can, have you considered hiring me for this, or can I help you with this thing? It's like, hey, have you considered this idea? That'd be a great opener. And let me bring you in, Robin. Hey, Robin, I got you unmuted.
Hi, Ed.
Hey. So does that make sense? Right, just a conversation opener. That will hopefully kickstart the discussion with a few of these folks.
Yes, it does. I've been listening to a lot of your podcasts and your training, and you were talking a lot about them having a client bring you in for that. And so I was trying to figure out what the best way was to talk to these guys as an opener. So these are my boating buddies.
Yeah. You know, it's the kind of thing that I like to brainstorm this kind of thing. And as you know, I actually use this strategy in my own business. It's the kind of thing. So I learned it from Dean Jackson. He's just a brilliant marketer. And he's got this thing that he talks about when it comes to short copy like this, that it's really short, but most of the time, the person who wrote it spent a lot of time thinking about it. About the exact right. words in the exact order. That's the beauty of that kind of copy, is that you wouldn't think that it took that much thought. So it's usually the kind of thing I have to think about behind closed doors, you know, like kind of like in my reading chair with a notebook. But yeah, mm-hmm. something like that, have you considered? Sometimes it could be something maybe a step removed from that. Like, are any of your customers going to be attending the ABC show? Right. So it's like, are any of your customers going? Not have you considered interviewing some of your customers? Because it could generate enough curiosity to respond where people will respond to it. So that's another thought. I think that's going to be more, I know it's could be awkward, but it's much more effective at starting the right conversations than an email blast will. So try that. Now, here's a way you could do it. And I do this myself. Here's a way you could diversify your risk. Let's say it's like, oh, this is the first time I do it. What if it doesn't work? You could do both. So you could start with a 9-word email. And then a couple of weeks later, when is the show, by the way?
Actually, there's one in 2 weeks, and then the next one's not until early December.
Okay, so there would be time for at least the one in December. Then a couple of weeks later, you can send out a longer email.
Right. Yeah, and that's not always a different audience. So some of them will be attending both shows.
Okay.
And then some of them will only be at one or the other.
Perfect. Yeah. So the subject line could read, have you thought about doing this? And then the email say, hey, have you thought about interviewing some of your successful customers for a case study while they're at the show? Many times that's a great opportunity. So this could be a longer email. It's not a 9-word email. It's a great opportunity to uncover these results, document them, and create a very powerful success story you could use in your sales and marketing efforts. That's exactly what I do. I'm going to be at the show. Now you can end up with a question though. Would you be interested in discussing this possibility or this idea?
Okay.
Something like that. Yeah, and that way you do both. And then the people who didn't respond to the 9-word email, you have this other email that's got a little bit more information because everyone's different. And sometimes it's a timing issue too. Like they didn't see that one where they meant to respond, but they didn't. Now they see this other one. So that way you're kind of diversifying your efforts. Yeah, but I would definitely try for the 1 in 2 weeks. It can't hurt.
Well, that's what I figured. I was just trying to rack my brain, trying to come up with something. And like I said, I know that they're bringing someone in. Actually, they're bringing in quite a few people in the marketing industry, but none of them are in the maritime industry, the marketers that they're bringing in to talk. So timing is going to be better because at least the ones that attend will at least know what I'm talking about now when I see them.
Perfect. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
All right. Great questions, guys. All right. So let's see. Tim has a question here. How long should I stick to a particular approach before moving to another? I'm approaching creative directors on LinkedIn, but not getting a great response over the last 2-3 months. What's a good way to evaluate when to cut bait and move on to a new fishing hole? Is this question too general? Yes and no. Sometimes, Tim, is not so much the approach as it is who you're contacting and what you're saying or asking, and how that matches up with how you're positioning yourself. So, and I'm not saying you're doing this, but take a look, make sure that it's not kind of a random throw spaghetti at the wall kind of approach. The criteria for selecting these prospects is sound. For instance, make sure that it's not just creative directors in your area. Like the fact that they're in your area doesn't really mean anything. Instead, that they're creative directors in ad or marketing agencies that have the kinds of clients that you have a lot of experience with. And that your message, your warm email in this example, references that, right? That it's based on this idea that you're connecting what they're doing and with what you do. So that's typically where 90% of the times that's where I see a problem, not so much that LinkedIn is not working and we got to move on to something else. You see what I'm saying? So I would look at that first because the people who get results with any kind of prospecting, they're doing a really good job of matching what the prospect is doing with what their experience or uniqueness is. So the more specific you can get, and sometimes you can't get that specific, but those who can get very specific tend to get really high response rates because it's so relevant and tailored to the prospect that it's almost inevitable, like 20% of prospects end up responding, as opposed to a more general scattered approach. You know, you may get 1%. Now, having said that, generally speaking, just to kind of give you a general rule of thumb with any kind of outreach like this, whether you're doing really good LinkedIn outreach or warm email prospecting, about 5%. So 1 out of 20 getting a positive response. Not positive response doesn't mean, hey, yes, I want to hire you. It just means maybe or maybe not now. Yes, we sometimes use outside designers, writers, whatever, but we don't have a need right now. That's still a positive response because it means yes, just not yes right now. So 1 out of 20, just to kind of give you a benchmark. So compare that to what you're getting and see how that looks. Alma has a question here. So I was fortunate enough to meet a graphic designer literally a month into my business who's kept me busy since then. Those projects were general and are just now slowing a bit, so I've done very little prospecting. The main question I have is that I feel I need to differentiate and establish positioning based on my background. How do I now pivot to that after generalizing for the last 8 months? Okay, so one way to do it, Alma, is to look at the work. And I'm assuming that you started your business about 8 months ago. So if that's when you started working with a designer and you had just launched your business and that was 8 months ago, I'm just the power of deduction. The first place I would look is what types of clients are there looking for patterns in terms of the work you've done, the types of businesses they've been, the types of writing, the topics, and see if you find some commonality. Let's just say that, I don't know, out of 10 projects, 3 or 4 had some things in common. That could be, look at that cluster, that could be something to grab onto. That could be a way to differentiate yourself. So even if, again, like I said earlier, you could still be a generalist, you could say, hey, and my specialty is working with organizations that do this. And you still don't have to talk about an industry or this type of project or similar projects such as X, Y, and Z. For example, long form content projects such as white papers, longer articles, reports. Notice, you know, that was project based, that was assignment based, but you're giving them examples. So, yeah, look for commonality. And then if you don't see anything there, I'll tell you what's the ideal combination is commonality and your background and experience, even outside of freelancing. So anything you've done before that, that ties well into that cluster that you found could be a really powerful combination. So you just kind of have to play with that. And listen, don't feel like it's got to be like solid as oak. If you can craft an argument based on that, that's a really good start and build on that. And then let's see where it takes you. Leslie says, clients are impressed with my background and samples, but when it comes to talking price, they walk away as I know they feel my prices are too high. I'm trying to offer a value package, but I feel they're shopping around. Leslie, so what's your question? I need something concrete because this could take us in many different directions. So let me know exactly how I can help you with that. What specifically do you want to know more about, or where can I help you with that? Hannah, any thoughts on bridging the gap between blog writing and case studies, white papers, etc.? When I prospect, I always mention these options, but blogging seems to be what people usually need. I built up samples with fairly well-paying clients, but want those bigger projects. A couple of people have asked me to send white paper samples. I said I didn't have any, but had written long articles and was confident I could do it, etc. Never heard back. A couple of case study projects fizzled out. Okay. The best thing you could do, or a couple of things. Go after prospects that are already doing the work you want to do. Okay. So, when you prospect, go after prospects that already have white papers published, number one. And that seems like a no-brainer, but I'm surprised how many people are going after a certain type of project and they don't even look to see if, well, does this company even seem to be doing this kind of work? The second thing is, leverage what you do have. So let's just say that you have experience in a certain topic or industry or area. Even if you don't have white paper experience, you know you could do it. It's just you need somebody to give you a shot. Then leverage the experience you have on that topic or that industry or that area. Okay. And what will happen is somebody will give you a shot eventually based on that experience. And then the issue of no samples is going to go away. This is a short-term problem. All you need is someone to give you a shot. Once you have that shot, you can have one sample. And then it becomes what? An order of magnitude easier, right? So you're really trying to fill this gap right now. The third thing I would say, and I just published an article about this on Sunday, is you're not looking for someone who needs to see all these samples. You're looking for someone who's willing to give you a shot with what they see right now. Okay. And you don't know what the situation is going to be. You can't possibly manufacture this. You just got to knock on enough doors that somebody will eventually say, yeah, you know what? That's good enough. Let's get started. And they'll give you a shot. And maybe they don't even ask for samples. Whatever the situation is, maybe it's urgent. Maybe they saw enough in you that they're willing to give you a shot. Maybe they're not that detail oriented and they overlooked the fact that you didn't have a white paper sample. Whatever, you don't know. There's a great scene in the movie Bridget Jones's Diary. And I've looked for it online before, and sometimes I can find it, but then the link moves and disappears. And for those of you who have seen it, it's a funny movie. So she's sleeping with her boss, and unfortunately, he cheats on her. Well, the next morning, she's got to go into the office and sit next to this guy, and she just can't stand it. So she quits. She quits her job right there on the spot. So she goes out looking for work, but she is just not qualified for these opportunities. So they show these scenes, scene after scene of all these interviews, and she is just floundering. They're asking her questions she can't answer, and she's just awkward, and she's just making a fool out of herself. So you could tell that after about six or seven of these, she's just exhausted. She's exhausted of not being authentic, of telling interviewees what they want to hear, but she's not being honest. So finally, they show the last interview, and the guy says, all right, well, why do you want to work here? Or why are you looking for a job? What happened in your last job? He said, well, I slept with my boss, and he cheated on me, so I can't stand to see him, so I'm looking for something else. He just flat out told him. And he closed his book and said, all right, great. Start at 8 o'clock Monday morning. And, you know, it's just a great lesson. Sometimes somebody may not care. That's what happened with me. That's what happened with most of the people I know. Somebody gave them a shot, and you're just looking for that opportunity. You just don't know where it's going to come from. So you leverage what you do have. Keep knocking. Somebody will give you a shot. There is an alternate situation or scenario. That is, you could create a fictitious white paper sample, or you could do a pro bono sample for somebody you know or somebody who's referred to you by somebody you know who owns a business. They have a situation where they could really use a white paper. That could be another possibility. If you're going to do that, and you don't necessarily need to do it, I suggest going and trying to do a pro bono project rather than doing something fictitious. And the reason is the experience you get from working with a real client, even if they're not paying you, is 10 times more valuable than writing something on your own. So, okay, let's see. Anne has a question. I'm working in business to business in the sustainable building industry, and I'm focusing on content. Is it okay to position myself as a content writer rather than a copywriter? I'm not sure if people search for content writers. Maybe they just search for copywriters who focus on content. Doesn't really matter, Anne. You can absolutely do it. The terms are often used interchangeably in business to business arena. So you can absolutely say content writer rather than copywriter. Not a problem. Robin just chimed in about our discussion earlier. Great advice. I love both clients and wouldn't want to lose either of them. So I might just keep them where they are and charge new clients the higher fee. Absolutely. There you go. And listen, I wouldn't give up on this idea of doing this annual increase. You know, think about 10%. You know, it's not a ton, but if it's recurring work, 10%, you know, that can add up. And then that gives you a little bit more, makes you feel a little bit better. It's enough to make a difference, but not so much that you risk losing them. Hey, Lanier, good to see you here. I'm trying to move from being paid by the hour to project and productized service work. But more often than not, when I do, I get burned, usually because there was more to the project than was explained, or I was able to ferret on discovery, or the client is challenged in some way and I need to spend more time with them than expected. I find this happens with productized services. The client quietly dovetails something aligned to the work and to what we're doing as if it's part of what we agreed to. I don't want to lose these clients, but I'm unsure how to handle it. All right. It's a couple of ideas. The first is, listen, when it comes to scope of work, you have to be clear in the scope. And when you know you're out of scope, you just have to speak up. I find that many of us, you know, we're service providers. So we aim to serve and to make clients happy. And I find that too many of us in that process give in too many times. And when you give in, you establish a new normal for the client every time. And, you know, where we started out is no longer the normal or the expectation. Now you're here. Big, big gap. So it's really hard to now go back and say, well, wait a minute, you know, this is not what we were supposed to be over here. And that just seems so far from where you are right now that the client now gets upset. They've even forgotten that they took you there little by little. So that's one thing. The second idea, and this is more practical, is with productized services, really with any service or any project where the scope of work is a bit undefined or not clearly defined or not every element is clearly defined, you're sometimes better off splitting the project into two phases or to two different projects. The first project is really about planning and defining the scope of work, and there's value there, and I'll talk about that. And then the second phase is about doing the thing. So it's like, let's plan the thing and then let's do the thing. And many times what we get in trouble is we try to do the thing and then price it as a fixed fee situation, but it hasn't been planned and it's kind of all over the place and then gets out of hand. And then, you know, the rest of the story. So one thing you could do is for projects where, you know, this is not very clearly defined or some areas are not clearly defined. You could scope out a project where you said, look, I'm going to help you on a consulting basis to plan this out. And the deliverable is going to be a step-by-step plan that includes, you know, all the elements, everything we need to do, who's going to be responsible, timelines, you know, the content, where it's going to come from, which pieces, whatever. Okay. And then you charge. I mean, it's going to be profitable, but that's not going to be the big moneymaker. That's a smaller engagement. And then once you have that, then we can now, and we agree on the scope based on this plan, now we have something tangible that I can then look at and price for you to do the thing. Okay, so many times, so two great instances of where this can come as a writer when this can really help. Websites, website copy, which many times you have no idea, and the client has no idea. They may have somewhat of a plan, but you don't know how many pages, how the page is going to look like, what kind of content is going to be on each page. Another one would be complex projects similar to that, like white papers, for instance, or big reports or marketing campaigns, nurturing campaigns, where things need to be defined first. Perfect situation to split it up like that. So anyway, hope that helps. All right, so I'm going to skip a couple of folks who have several questions here. I just want to make sure I get to everybody, okay? So I'm not purposely ignoring you. I just want to make sure I give everyone a shot. If we have time, I'll come back to you, okay? So, Robin, I'll come back to you. I know you have some other questions here. Hey, you know what? While I'm reading through these, I'd love to hear what's been most valuable for you so far. Let me know in the chat area. Just type in a capital V for valuable. And let me know, out of everything we've talked about so far, either the material I introduced earlier, some of these discussions we've had, what stands out? What's been most valuable so far? I'd just love to hear what's resonating with you guys. All right. Let's see. Jean has a question about nonprofits. Nonprofits, especially policy and oriented ones, need help with case studies and white papers related to political and social issues. If you're looking for pro bono clients, consider a nonprofit, especially one that's related to your industry, if possible. You'll be helping yourself and a worthy organization at the same time. I think it's excellent advice. So thank you, Jean. I forgot who asked the question about white papers. I think it was Hannah. Yeah, Hannah. So I think it's a great idea. It's a great, great idea. So Weiss, valuable so far, most valuable. Jean says cash flow management, good. Leslie likes the idea of splitting the project into two parts, planning and then creating the project, awesome. Shannon, need to do more prospecting. We generally don't do enough, 1 in 20 positive response ratio, good. Alma, this Q&A is extremely valuable, thank you. Robin, the 9-word email and productize into two phases. Cynthia says profit first. Robin says, slides at the beginning were great, and I love having one access to you, Ed. Your real-time advice is awesome. Great. Thank you, Robin. Appreciate that. Jennifer says, what you just talked about, pitching your client on a plan to help them get organized. Yeah, now, of course, with these things, it's important that you just don't position it as like, let me help you get organized. You need to pitch the value, right, the benefit they're going to get. Yeah, you're going to get clarity. You're going to have a map. You're going to know exactly how to approach the thing. Right, as opposed to making it sound like it's a favor to you. Hey, listen, you need to get organized. And I know you wouldn't do that, but just as a warning, you got to be careful there because otherwise the value is not going to come through. Hannah says, valuable positioning and differentiating. Leslie says, how to narrow down your niche and specialty. Good. Carol, the Q&A has been most valuable because it brings up points you may not have thought of. Oh, excellent. Yeah, I know when I come to these things, like I learn – as an attendee, as much from the questions others have as those I might have. So, Liz says, so far, valuable strategy in blogging. You're confirming that my approach, CPA who writes for accountants, is right on. Absolutely. Not that there was ever any doubt, Liz. What was the cash flow management book, Hannah? It's called Profit First. Profit First. Just look it up. Amazon, it'll pop up right away. Excellent. It will make your head hurt. It's one of those books you're not gonna, I would not read it all the way through and then try to implement it. What I did is I read about 25% of the way through and then I realized, okay, I gotta put this down and I gotta start taking action. Set up my accounts, work through that worksheet that he's got in there, and then okay, then it's like one chapter at a time. Read it, implement it, read it, implement it, read it, implement it. Shannon also says, reminder about thinking strategically. Yeah, foundation first. Absolutely. Okay. All right. So let me go back some of these questions. I think we're kind of on round two here. Just bear with me, guys. I got to sort through some of these. All right, so Robin has a question here. Facing a difficult decision. As we've talked about before, I have a full-time job I actually love that comes with great perks like company-subsidized health insurance and a 401k match. I'm a single mom with two kids, so those benefits are attractive, but I've been in negotiations with my employer about a raise and a possible promotion, and that isn't going the direction I had hoped. So I'm thinking about potentially making the leap to full-time freelancer at the end of the year. I think I can get the clients once I kick my prospecting into high gear. I've been testing the waters, but I'm afraid to prospect now because I don't have the capacity to take on the work unless I'm full-time. Any advice on straddling the divide here? Yes, it's such a difficult challenge because, yeah, Ed, I get it. Prospecting, I'm book solid. I got a full-time job. I'm trying to do this on the side. I'm booked there too. I got kids. What am I supposed to do? The biggest thing you can do, Robin, and listen, you got to be open-minded right now, okay? Because what I'm about to tell you might force you to move this date in terms of making this break if you do make it. The best thing you can do is create a savings buffer. Okay. I would buy and read Profit First. That's going to help. But even if you don't do that, create a savings buffer. Give yourself a cash cushion that will give you the runway you need to make this transition without losing sleep. The last thing you want to do is feel emotionally dependent on your freelance clients, because once you cut the cord, it's now you're going to feel fully dependent, which is not the best place or the best situation to be in to make smart decisions. So give yourself that cushion. I'm not a financial planner, so I can't tell you what that looks like for you. Every person is also different. I'll tell you what I did, which might seem completely nuts, okay? But when I did this, a similar situation as you, sole breadwinner, kids, like, oh my gosh, first time cutting the cord, I did 1 year's worth of living expenses, not income, living expenses, because if you need it, you're going to cut back, right, on your expenses. You're not going to live fully like you normally would. That's 1 year. Looking back, that was a little overdone. I mean, I'm glad I did it, but I didn't need to. I was overly cautious. So you got to figure out what that is for you. You work in financial services. I'm sure you know what that's going to be for you. But that really answers addresses the dilemma, because you're limited capacity-wise right now in terms of who you can take on. And sure, you could raise your fees for your next prospect, but again, it's a capacity issue. But if you can beef up your savings and buy yourself some runway, then even if you have to move your date to leave, then that makes things a lot easier. I suspect that what will happen, Robin, so that's the responsible thing to do. Let's talk about what I think will happen is, I think once you cut the cord, you'll be unleashed out there in the world. And I think you're going to find that you can do some damage in a good way. You'll be able to do really well, and you're going to be glad you did it. But you got kids, you got responsibilities, so you got to play it safe. Again, disclaimer, I'm not a financial planner. I don't play one on the internet, yada, yada, yada. All right, let's see. So Robin also had some feedback, I think, for Tim. The approach I've been using on LinkedIn is, if someone looks at my profile, I message them and say, hey, I noticed you viewed my profile, and we're generally in the same industry. So I'll send them a connection request with a note and say, happy to connect, and here's what I do. And if there's anything I can help you with, please don't hesitate to reach out. I haven't gotten any work from it yet, but I've made some great connections with this approach. Yeah, cool. There's also some great training in the academy on using LinkedIn as a prospecting tool. So I did it with Melanie Dodaro, and we updated it a few months ago. So check that out, Tim, if you haven't already. That's a great execution plan, and the updates are on top. She's got a very clear step-by-step process, which is has some of what Robin just talked about here. Cynthia says, do you have any suggestions on how to deal with procrastination due to fear? Yeah. That's a big topic. So I'm going to give you one suggestion that's very practical. First of all, you're not alone, Cynthia. I procrastinate every week. And many times it's out of fear. I've identified that many times it's either fear or confusion as to where to start, which is usually a byproduct of overwhelm. It's like, it feels so big. I can't think about that right now. I'll do it later. But fear is one of the biggest drivers of procrastination. And one of the best things you could do is to think about what one simple, small action you could take today to make progress. That's it. I mean, like, And I want you to think in terms of it's so ridiculously simple and small that you'd be ashamed if you wrote it down, this is what I'm going to do today, and you didn't do it. I mean, you would just lose hope. So the example I like to use is one from a book called Mini Habits. He calls it the golden push-up. It's like, you know, I've been procrastinating working out. And there are lots of reasons for that. I'm not sure what to do. It seems like such a far drive to the gym. I'm just lazy, whatever. And what he says is, look, what if you set a goal to do one push-up today? Before the day is over, in your home office, you're going to get on the floor and you do one push-up. I can't think of a good enough reason not to do it. I mean, who could, right? So you do one push-up. Now, what happens when you're down there on the floor? You do one push-up. Are you going to stop? Probably not. You're probably going to see how many more you could do. Before you know it, you've done 15 push-ups. Maybe you decide to do another set. And now the blood's flowing. You're feeling good. You do some sit-ups. And then you do some jumping jacks. And then you decide, you know what? I'm going to go get a glass of water. I'm going to go out for a walk. Now, maybe you don't do all these things, okay? But you've done, let's just say you do the first thing. You do one push-up and then you say, you know, I'm going to do some more. And you do 15. Psychologically, the impact that has is immense. And what that does is now you feel like you set out to do something important and you did it. And not only that, you did extra. And whether it's fear, whether it's confusion, overwhelm, laziness, it doesn't matter. It works the same way. Figure out one micro action you can take to make progress with that thing and give yourself a pat on the back and do it like your life depended on it. That has worked miracles for me. When it doesn't work, it's because it's too big. The task I choose is too big. So reduce it to a point where you just can't help but get it done. Alma says you don't like the word niche. Why is that? Okay, here's why. Because the way it's usually used in our world. In our world, the way many teachers use the word niche is to refer to an industry. And even though that's not what it means, but it's been attached and associated with the word industry. So what happens is people who can't think of an industry that would be best for them give up on the idea or never start. And I think that's unfortunate. Niche does not mean industry. So what I like to do is I like to talk about target market, because a target market is a type of client that you're trying to go after. And a target market can be defined many different ways. It could be an industry. That's the most common way of defining a target market. Hey, I go after insurance companies, or I go after companies that sell scientific equipment. But your niche could be that. Your niche could be that you focus on a certain type of project or a certain type of marketing. Let's say that you do social media marketing or you do case studies only. Okay, so that's your niche, but that's not your target market. You still have to define your target market. Well, I do case studies for companies selling complex products and services. Ah, okay, now we're getting somewhere. So you need to have all these elements defined, and I find when people when people are forced to come up with a niche, automatically they're being, the assumption is that it has to be an industry, which is not the case. And that creates all kinds of problems. So I like to use more specific language to make sure we cover all the bases and that you think about the problem from multiple different angles. Let's see here. Francis has a question. I've never gotten any positive response to job board listings for copywriter. Warming prospecting is complex and time-consuming in finding meaningful connections. I think I should do the freelance sites like Upwork and Writer's Work to get some experience and client feedback. I could use to attract more serious clients. Okay, so Francis' question is really, hey, I haven't gotten success in job boards, and I find that warming up prospecting takes a lot of time. I think I should maybe try Upwork because there's so many opportunities there. Maybe the assumption is I can get a lot of experience. So here's the thing, guys. Just because there are a lot of posted opportunities on a job board doesn't mean that you're going to have a fair shot at them. Okay, so it's really an equation. Number of opportunities, number of people going after them, right? Because if you got tens of thousands of opportunities, but 200,000 people going after them, then there's an imbalance. Okay, so sometimes all we look at is this, and we don't take into account the full picture. So make sure you do that, because Upwork is no picnic. There's serious competition from all over the world there. It's a race to the bottom. I'm not saying you can't do it, and I'm not saying you can't get success there, but I'm saying it doesn't offer advantages that many people think they offer. Number two, when it comes to warm email prospecting, one of the biggest misconceptions that writers and freelancers in general have is that you have to work really hard to find something about the prospect that you could talk about and match it to what you do and what you're about. It's like, hey, you know, I noticed that you guys are embarking on this strategy or in this initiative. And, you know, that's interesting because I used to be in this business and we did something similar. And the chances of you finding something like that for every prospect are slim. The good news is you don't need anything that specific. Just pointing out something that you notice about them. Say, hey, wonderful article. I love your blog post, you know, especially the one from last week on XYZ. Great point about that you made about whatever. The reason I'm reaching out is I work with companies like yours to help them write X, Y, or Z. And depending on how you're doing these right now, I may be able to help you. Here's a link to my website, which will tell you a little bit more about what I do, what makes me different. Should we connect? Notice that about 90% of that script you could reuse from one prospect to the next. It's really that first 10% that you have to change. And notice that 10%, I mean, it wasn't anything that took an hour to come up with. You just notice something you can point to. In fact, some of my coaching clients who are getting the best results with warm email prospecting, interestingly enough, are keeping it that generic or many times even worse. And I'm even surprised many times at the response rates they're getting. So don't feel like you have to come up with, like you have to do this deep research and uncover some amazing things that are going to blow them away. Many times what happens is that doesn't get any better results than a more, I wouldn't say generic approach, but an approach that didn't quite take that kind of research. In fact, sometimes it can get worse. Don't ask me why. I got some theories as to why, but it just, so anyway, don't feel like you have to go in this direction. And don't feel like, you know, Upwork, again, it's all opportunity, because you got to look at the opportunity and who else is in there. What about trying to get work with agencies? Absolutely. So agencies, they're a great source. However, with agencies, the best advice I can give you is don't just position yourself as someone who can handle their overflow work, okay? Because any writer can do that. To the point that I made earlier in today's call, you have to show why you're different. So what I would do is I would go after agencies that have clients or go after clients like the ones that you are positioning yourself to go after. So in other words, if you have a background in, you know, you're a scientist and you're going after companies that sell scientific products, then go after agencies that target those types of clients. And then leverage your differentiator as kind of the key. That's what's really going to get their attention. Not, hey, from time to time, if you have overflow work, I'd love to be considered. That's not going to work. And if it does work, it commoditizes you immediately, because now you're a helper, not someone who could help them with something a little bit more strategic. You're now just someone who can, you're a body. And you don't want to position yourself as a warm body. Oh, good, Robin. Thanks. I'm glad this was helpful. Fireside chat has been extremely helpful. I got my mind focused again. Awesome. Great to hear it. Great to hear it. All right, guys, we got time for one more question, if anyone has something. Kimberly says, I second the advice on agencies. I got my agency client last month and mentioned my specialty because that's who they serve. There you go. That's what's going to get their attention. The great thing about agencies is they're constantly in need for writers, right? Much of what they do involves writing, but most of them also don't have staff writers. So if you approach agencies, you're approaching them about something that they constantly need. But the key is explain what makes you different. Explain what you bring to the table that somebody else can't teach you overnight. Thank you, Francis. Glad it was helpful. All right, guys, let's do this. I don't see any of the questions. Let's do a kind of a quick walk around the room, if you will. And here's what I'd love to hear from you. I want you to go into the chat area and type it a capital A. Capital A. And then tell me one action item that's like at the top of your list. Based on what we talked about here, whether it's something we talked about explicitly or maybe an idea that was triggered by something we discussed. Just, I want you to write down, type in one action item, something you're going to take action on, let's just say over the next 48 hours. And you know, keep it simple, something that you know you could do, as we talked about a few minutes ago, something simple, something that's doable. I want to make sure you walk away with something actionable. I don't want this to be a, hey, this was really helpful. It got me, give me clarity, help me stay focused. Those are all great things. But if you don't have something concrete that you can put into play, the value from this time was limited. So I want to make sure you have something tangible. All right. Robin says, this is my first fireside chat. Awesome. Can't wait for the next one. Robin, curious to know, did that help about the in terms of giving yourself that runway? Love to know if that resonated with you. And she says, top action item, buy profit first. Lanier, action item, nail my differentiation. Absolutely. Cynthia, work on my website copy. Alma, clearly writing out what my differentiator is. Here you go. Leslie, prospecting for new clients. Robin, personal emails to my list for the upcoming show. And by the way, Robin, in the bonuses area in the academy, you'll see the email prospecting playbook. So if you need some ideas or you need to refresh on this concept, you'll see it there. Francis, action item, try to connect with agencies using the right approach. Tim, warming prospecting to my recent LinkedIn agency contacts. Wonderful. Liz, action item, carve out time for prospecting and marketing. Kimberly, re-listen to the section on trade shows and approaches, as I'll be attending a few next year. Good stuff. All right. Leslie, do more prospecting on LinkedIn. Connect with 3 prospects in some way. Seek connection or respond to a post. There you go. That's very, very doable. Robin, yes, totally resonated. The runway, I have 4 months set aside, but might want to make that cushion a little bigger. Hey, that's a great start. Again, you're the only one who can make that decision. And I think, too, what you'll find, Robin, is you'll be conservative, too. Once you go out on your own, I know, like, we really scaled back. We were living very frugally, which is great, you know. So, Gene, listen to podcasts on LinkedIn marketing. Okay. Yeah, Gene, check it out, the execution plan, actually, inside the academy on LinkedIn prospecting. Definitely check that one out. Hannah, action item, tweak my prospecting email for target market. Bobby, making up my mind that I still want to do this. Awesome. Robin, I keep your book at my desk side at all times. Oh, thank you. So hopefully not for the reasons that some people think, right? Some books I keep on my bedside because if I need to fall asleep quickly, those are the ones that I turn to. Carol, within 40 hours, I'm going to finish my website. Shouldn't take more than an hour and start my blog. Write at least 5 posts before I publish so I can better market myself as a content marketing writer. There you go. Oh, and maybe send out 5 warm emails. Absolutely. Carol, and you know what's so cool about that? You can repurpose that content. So if you publish that, guess what? A couple weeks later, send that out as a newsletter. A couple weeks after that, publish it to LinkedIn Publisher. Okay. So get it out there. Create, get into the habit of creating content once and publishing multiple times. You can splinter bits and pieces, stats, ideas, quotes, quotable lines from that stuff, use it in social media, lots of different things you can do. So don't feel like every time you write a post, that's it. That's like the end of the line and I can't get any more value out of that. Get into the habit of repurposing content. Tracy Glass, raise my rates. I've done it before, but I know it's time to do it again. This is the best time to do it, Tracy. Best time to do it. Here's another challenge for you guys. Guess what? Next prospect, next incoming, it doesn't really matter if it's incoming or you did the outreach. Try this little experiment. Raise your fee by 20%. And you don't have to tell them it's an increase. If you normally charge $1,000 for something and you would have normally charged $1,000 for the situation, charge $1,200. Watch what happens. I guarantee you that 80% of the time, if not more, you're going to get the $1,200. You're going to get the higher amount. So try that out on your next opportunity, 20% higher. If it just doesn't seem even possible, if you can't even quote it confidently because it's just so out of range, try 10%. Okay. The percentage doesn't really matter as much as the fact that you've really pushed yourself. Okay. Jay, action item, procrastination, push through on project, been putting off for 12 days. Okay, good. Hopefully what I shared helped a little. Jennifer, ironically, maybe focus on some client projects. I haven't been able to get my head in the game this week. Okay, week's young. Brew some coffee, let's get going. Liz Farr, to Robin, I did it, you can do it too, but definitely follow Ed's advice. Yeah, awesome, Liz. So Liz left her job not too long ago, and it was a big transition. She had very well-paid job, and I think what she would tell you is she prepared for it, right? Number one, Liz, and number two, she hit the ground running, and because now she had no safety net of sorts, she became more creative, a little more assertive, took more action. Of course, you now had the time to do it and the mental bandwidth. So, Ryan says, no, the book is my WP Bible. Okay, good. thanks so much. Yes, guys, this is great. So I'm glad this was useful for you. I appreciate you coming in, being good sports, and sharing some of this with me. And we recorded this. So if you came in late or you want to go back to something I said, we're going to post this in the next couple of days, and we'll have it in the bonuses area of the Academy. So thanks again for coming in. Guys, great chat. I didn't really quite have a fireplace behind me. Maybe when it cools off a little bit, I'll have a virtual flame back there. But you guys have a great rest of the day. Take care.